The eighth chapter begins a bridge. And remember, the subject of the book of Hebrews is Jesus. That's the subject of this book. The eighth chapter is a bridge out of discussions of the priesthood to a discussion of the tabernacle. He sums up in the opening of the eighth chapter. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. He talks of the priesthood. He then, in the fifth verse, begins to anticipate what will be the subject of the eighth and ninth chapters, the shadow of heavenly things in the Old Testament worship practices. He says of these things, starting the priest, but he's going to move on to the tabernacle, these serve under the example and shadow of heavenly things. And because Moses, who was God's instrument to set the worship practices and build the tabernacle or name the pattern that had been given to him by God, Moses then, as the custodian of God's blueprint, since it was God's blueprint of examples and shadows that were to teach eternal things that would be fulfilled in New Testament unfolding of the Son of God, the living Word, Moses was admonished when he was about to make the tabernacle. Admonished of God, "See, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises." And with a quick leap, it turns from Moses to Jesus, who established a better ministry, is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. That's a lot of better. Better, better, better. It's going to get gooder and gooder as we go into this book. And that's where I want to camp. I want us to look at this Old Testament pattern. Last time we looked at the pattern by jumping ahead and seeing that the pattern is not given on some mount that can be touched with hands, we come to Jesus. And we hung that pattern up in front of us in the last lesson. Now I'm going to back up. And back up to the example. And back up to the shadow. And back up to the pattern in detail given by Moses, which, and I'm going to do it in reverse of what's said here, which was not as good as what we have, which is better. I can say simple things and make them sound complicated. We're going to look at that which was, in order to abundantly prove, as good as it was, what we have is better. And in so doing, we're going to add color and meaning and truth and detail to that which is the better, namely Jesus. And you've heard me say it, let me write it down. Enfolded into the Old Testament are the truths of the New Testament. Unfolded in the New Testament are the truths of the Old Testament. Both are there. And just about every truth you find unfolded in the New Testament, if you look for it, you'll find it enfolded in picture form or detail in the Old Testament. And together, they give us full understanding of what God is saying. And we see by the contrast as well as the example how much better we have it. Get ready for a trip that proves what this verse is saying as we look at the Old Testament tabernacle in more detail than I've ever done in my ministry before. We're going to see that example and shadow of heavenly things, that if we go home each night for a few Sunday nights saying how wonderful that revelation, we ought to be shouting with joy and singing how much better we have it as we look at this old tabernacle. The Old Testament tabernacle was God's covenanted meeting place.
When God created man, God and man in the garden had no friction, no problems. Man was denied something and given a choice. He was given access to everything in the garden. God put him over all created things, and he gave him dominion over this earth. He told him he couldn't eat of one tree. Isn't that insidious? You have everything but one thing. But that's the thing he wanted. And you notice that's the only thing the prince of the power of the air wanted him to have. That's where all the pressure came, was on that which God said no to. I think God could have named anything that he was going to deny and had the same results. Man listened to the devil and sinned. His sin was rebellion. His sin was direct contradiction of God's law. His sin was to fall short of the ideal of obedience. He had access to God. God was the source of life. Henry Drummond has defined life as capacity to relate to one's environment. He had daily contact with the source of life. God came down at the cool of the day and walked and talked with him. God said the penalty for eating of that one tree was death. Man ate. He was driven from the garden. Contact with the source of life broken. And cherubims with flaming swords were put at the entrance. Now, it doesn't really matter to me whether a person wants to take this and put poetic meaning on it or literal. You want to know where I stand? I always interpret God's book as meaning exactly what it says. I figure that that form that Satan took looked like a snake. I don't think God was trying to write poetry. But it doesn't matter what the interpretation. The net result was a separation, a wall of partition. The New Testament unfolds it in words like that. There is a wall of partition between God and man. And man was prevented access to the source of life itself. I have Jesus' authority in John 17, who sums up everything. He says, "This is life eternal, that a man may know the one true God, and Jesus Christ, whom he hath sent." But man was separated from even knowing God. The wall was there. And for God to come to man was to compromise his integrity and do something other than what he said. The man began to die at that instant and been dying ever since, cut off from the source of life. And the whole revelatory plan is God's revealing of the way in which he restored the broken connections between us. He's never been lost. There was between us and him that wall of partition created by our sins. And God has been the hunter. God has been the one seeking to leap the gap, and to leap it in such a way that did not deny his own integrity. For he said, "For sin comes death." And for him to do other than keep his word is to put insecurity in the relationship. If he just leaped the fence and said, "I'm tired of being away from you, I want to join again," I'm equally insecure that he may say, "I'm tired of being with you," and jump the line again. God, to give security in the relationship, had to keep his word. He said, "For sin comes death." In the councils of heaven, we get it out of the book of Acts, we get it out of Romans. In the councils of heaven, before the worlds were formed, God had a fail-safe program. There was a lamb slain from the foundation of the world. There was a life worth more than all the lives of man put together, that one day in the fullness of time would pay the penalty of man's sin and die on a hill one day, and restore the relationship by paying the penalty and thereby breaching the gap, that God might now come to find the lost sheep and take up his habitation, his abode in relation with us again, in between. All of God's book is a revelation of His terms for temporary relationship. And He writes all the terms. You don't bargain with Him. God could be no other than Himself, and in order to relate to man temporarily, until this wall of petition was broken, He had to relate on His terms with temporary medium of exchange. Now, that's not complicated. I'm not going to take the time to illustrate it tonight, but I could draw illustrations from many areas, from law, from economics. The one I've used most often is out of the monetary world. You don't have to understand much about high finance to go spend a dollar bill. The intrinsic value of a dollar bill is very little. The value of the dollar bill, the spendability of it, is the value placed and protected in that dollar bill by the power that stands behind it, that has in its vaults enough surety of real money that will buy and sell on any market of exchange, that anybody anywhere, should they challenge that paper, will take in place of the paper that's being spent. You don't have to know much about high finance. Go spend that dollar. The government just says, worth a dollar. You go buy dollars worth of goods. Let somebody challenge it. And in theory, the government that stands behind that money will come up out of its bank or its vault with the surety to buy up all of that paper. That's God. He had in the bank of heaven enough surety that the angels that look on will judge God's integrity. The accuser of the brethren that would charge in as he did in the days of Job, your own conscience, or anyone else that would challenge God's right to relate to us on the basis of His integrity, He had to have the surety hidden away in His vaults to buy up everything that every challenge might be silenced. But en route, these people that were His oracle were drawing pictures in their lives, examples and shadows. And He related temporarily because He had the surety. But He protected the truth in the relationship. To meet God in Old Testament times, Old Covenant times, He wrote the terms. You didn't just charge up and say, hey, God, I'm here. Wake up, speak up, or get out of the way, I'm going to do it my way. Like some people boldly use God today, a bolt out of the blue or a rip in the ground would cut Him down to size in a hurry. Now, we live in a skeptical age. Not so with these Old Testament saints. God on that mountain touched with fire said how He would relate to them. He said, I'll meet you in a tabernacle in this place, fences around it, an interior curtain section, the holy of place and the holy of holies, and an outer court surrounding the gate, which is the east gate. I don't know which direction is which down here anymore. Never did really get it straightened out, so that's east for purpose of teaching tonight. I don't know, it depends on where your television's set, sitting in your home. That's east. The tribe of Judah was right there. And God said to those people that were in the camp surrounding it, and the tabernacle was in the middle of the camp, if you want to meet me and be accepted in my presence and be heard of me, here's the place. And to get to me, you got to go through Judah, through a door, through a fence, past a brazen altar, past a laver of cleansing, into a holy place with pieces of furniture, and into the Holy of Holies, and once a year I'll listen to your representative as he comes in, if he does it my way. You say, oh, that's too complicated. 7.5 feet, they're even jumping that high nowadays. I can high jump that thing. That's the skeptic. I used to think that God had to fit my categories. I grew up in a generation more skeptical than this one. I remember how you could always get a hearing to the story. There was a current story going around. All Sunday school teachers listened to it about the little kid that came home from Sunday school. The boy and his daddy said, what'd you learn in Sunday school today? He said, well, it told us about a guy named Moses got in a fight with a king named Pharaoh. And he said, I don't know what the deal was, but Moses was leaving with his people, and Pharaoh was chasing him. And the guns were going kablowy, and the tanks were charging. And he, all of a sudden, his scouts up front radioed back and said, hey, what we do? We're coming to a big old sea. And Moses radioed back and said, well, put some pontoons on it. Let's get over that sea. So they went to work, got the pontoons laid. Moses lined up all of his army. He got the tanks in one row and the artillery in another row. And they went on those pontoons, got over the other side. And when they got on the other side, Moses radioed some of his engineers, and he says, you put some dynamite in those pontoons. And right behind him came Pharaoh with his guns and his tanks and his artillery, and he charged right out on those pontoons. And about the time he got in the middle, Moses radioed his engineers and said, you punch that plunger and you blow those pontoons up. And kablowy, boom, boom, it all went up. Down in the sea went all of Pharaoh's guns, his artillery, his tanks. And the father says, son, did your Sunday school teacher tell you that story? He said, well, not exactly, but you'd never believe it the way she told it to me. I don't use humor very often. But that's the state of mind that prevailed with me and all the rest of the smart aleks trying to fit God into our categories. Will you put flesh and blood on these people tonight? And will you go back and make that march with them? I have an idea, if I'd watched that Red Sea swallow up Pharaoh after walking on dry ground, looking up at that water walled up, I'd have grabbed to you. You might find this hard to believe, but I'd have gotten the tambourine, danced with Miriam and the rest of them. I'd have been a believer when I saw God do that. And when the sister of our leader began to get uppity and presumptuous and laid a trip on her brother, said, we're just as good as you, and God smote her with leprosy, I'd say I better tread softly around God. And when Korah and his bunch began to criticize, and the earth opened up and swallowed them up, it would be very easy for me to keep my mouth shut for a while. I'd be a believer. I wouldn't need proofs. It'd be enough for me to know I want on God's side. Doesn't matter what the terms are. If he says this is the way to go, that's the way I'm going to fly. Now, until you come into that frame, you can't understand. God does not debate. It's his grace, unmerited favor. God's word said, die. They were in a slow dying death, and when that was over, that was it. God in love was given a way back. That's why grace, the Greek word, was seized upon by New Testament writers to describe our relationship to God. Charisma. One of the derivatives of the word speaks of the gifts we receive from God, because they're equally undeserved. But the word that is the root of it all, charisma, means unmerited favor. If I get anything I get from God because of anything I've done or any deserving on my part, it's not charisma. Unmerited favor. You don't think the devil's forever trying to change things around? Look what he's done to that word charisma. Now, charisma is a personality projection, something that someone has that gets attention to them. It's that which exalts the self. When you have it, you're set apart because of charisma. The devil's forever trying to destroy every word that God uses. Charisma in the New Testament leaves me with nothing save his love. Unmerited favor. How'd you get to God then, with him writing all the terms? And I hope that it will come alive as we see that only a divine hand could have written this book. This is a miserable bunch of people that God selected as his oracle. Yet in spite of their disobedience, God would make them become his mouthpiece, if not in word, in the very history of their nation, or in the way in which he made them relate to him. And look at the way God anticipated as he outlined the tribes around the tabernacle. Judah was at that eastern side. You had to go through the tribe of Judah to even get to the tabernacle. The tabernacle was Jesus. He's the way, the truth, and the life. He was the Lion of the tribe of Judah. God leaves no detail to chance. Even in making that rebellious people march in the desert, He made sure when they camped that Judah was always at this gate. Even though Judah had miserable representatives, He anticipated that day when the Lion of the tribe of Judah, that greater son of David, would be the doorway to grace and the unveiling of all that God was going to bring. That bunch of dummies didn't even know why they were camped there, but God was in control. So in order to get there, you went through Judah, and you came to a tabernacle. God was inside, where He met him. 7.5 feet high. Immediately you were confronted with a white linen fence. The very whiteness of the fence and the geographic separation between me and God, if I were that believer coming, told me the truth that goes clear back to this early declaration of God, without holiness no man shall see God. And the whiteness of the fence spoke that truth to me. But if I needed illustration, from my youth up, I had been taught the meaning of these symbols. Running down to the ground outside ran brass chains attached to brass pegs, and this fence was held up by black acacia wood posts hidden behind the white. But the base of the posts were seated in oblong blocks of brass. Now, brass always symbolized judgment. When you come inside to the altar of sacrifice, they literally call it the brazen altar. It's where sacrifice for sin was offered. It was a brazen serpent raised in the wilderness in that time when the serpents were biting them. Brass from their youth up taught of judgment, God's judgment on sin. Now put yourself in this picture, coming and wanting to be accepted of God, walking through the tribe of Judah. You could come to the entrance, but if you came any other way, you would confront this 7.5 foot high fence, and the first thing jutting to the outside, brass chains, brass pegs, and coming under the wall, brass oblong blocks of brass that would jut outside the fence. Everywhere outside was brass, symbolizing judgment if you remain separated from God. But look up. The tops of the fence, every post seated in brass, was crowned with silver. And every bit of silver in the tabernacle was made from the silver half shekel given as redemption money. When the tribe of Israel was numbered, they were to give redemption money. And that redemption money, the silver half shekel, went into the tabernacle and was beaten down and became all the silver elements. And again, from youth up, silver in contrast to brass symbolized redemption. Judgment was his lot if he remained outside, but follow that silver chain. From post top to post top, didn't matter which direction you went, it brought you around to where the tribe of Judah was, to one door on the east side through which you could walk inside the fence. This door bore four colors: blue, red or scarlet, purple, you know, I write bad enough without a wiggly board. Blue, red, purple, and white. Four colors. Some people wonder why four gospels. Blue always symbolized the eternal nature of God. That's John's view of Jesus. Red symbolized the suffering servant. That's Mark's view of Jesus. Purple, the kingship, the King of Kings. That's Matthew's picture of Jesus. White, the perfection that was his. He perfectly fulfilled the law, the perfect man. That's Luke's view that's given of Jesus. No accidents in God's book. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. That simplifies it. But even back here, through the tribe of Judah, out of which sprang that lineage of descendants that brought forth Jesus, the Son of David, to the one door, or follow the silver chain that symbolized redemption, to one door you could walk inside this fence into the outer court of the tabernacle area, the colors cunningly woven by the women. I could camp on that, but that Son of God was born of woman, conceived of the Spirit, and He became the door. God, in precise detail, blue symbolizing divinity. John, where did He begin? Your subject matter usually is determined by your starting point. Where does John's gospel begin? In the beginning was the Word. Where does Mark's gospel begin? You know, the problem of the Jews is they were looking for a Messiah, but they had their eyes on those grander pictures of the Deliverer in the book of Daniel and in the book of Enoch, where He comes as the Son of Man on the clouds of glory. They neglected to read Isaiah, the prophet of the suffering servant, but they were looking for a Messiah that was prophesied about by the prophets. Mark gives us the starting point. He starts with the prophets. You read his gospel. But he shows that out of the prophets there was the suffering servant to come. Where are we going to find Matthew, who writes to those that look for a king? You read it close, he's going to start with the lineage of David. Go back to the faith of Abraham. And if you read Luke, he's going to start with the historians. He says there have been many attempts to put this down in correct form, but I'm going to put it together right. Now, I'm paraphrasing him, but he starts with the historians. God has no accidents in this book. I'd have to be awful dumb to not see that way back there, God, who knew a barrier had to be breached and who had in the bank that life that would pay it all and shed the blood that we heard the dove sing about earlier. He's telling us all along the only basis of this temporary relationship is that Son of God. He says it everywhere you turn. The tribe of Judah, the silver chain of redemption that comes from a payment of ransom money. Jesus said all this world could only be set right if He gives His life for ransom. The door. He said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh save by Me. I'm the door of the sheep cot. And that's a little different illustration, because they felt the sheep as they came in, lest in darkness they would miss something that came through, and the shepherd protected that very doorway as he'd feel a sheep coming through. He was the door. The colors are true throughout. Those colors will occur again and again. Immediately, as you come in, you come to that brazen altar, sometimes called the altar of burnt offering. It was made of acacia wood and brass. And remember that, acacia wood is going to crop out again and again. It's that black, dry wood of the desert. He was a root out of a dry ground. The black acacia wood symbolizes humanity, and in the tabernacle it symbolizes the humanity that Jesus assumed. And you'll find again and again, the acacia wood is mixed with gold. And write it down so you'll be prepared for the symbols. Gold always symbolized divinity. Silver always symbolized redemption. Brass always symbolized judgment. And you'll find no deviation. In the outer court, you find brass and acacia wood. But when you move in here, you're going to find gold and acacia wood. But out here, God's still dealing with man's sin. A door has been provided past the brass that symbolized judgment, but you confront it again. Acacia wood overlaid with brass, where the root out of the dry ground, which is Jesus, who one day left heaven's splendor and laid aside the glory. How do I know that? He prays in John 17, Father, restore to Me the glory which I had with You. He took upon Himself the form of a servant, as Philippians 2 says. He tented in human flesh. He became a root out of dry ground. He moved into black acacia wood. He was made in the likeness of sinful flesh. Though he did not sin, he took this form and he perfectly blended the divine and that black acacia wood until later in this tabernacle we will see the perfection of Jesus in that form. But at this altar, he is coated and covered with the brass of judgment on our behalf. He lays the gold aside and takes the brass because he becomes our altar. He becomes our high priest. He becomes our offering. He becomes our sacrifice. Everything in this tabernacle is Jesus through and through. He's out of Judah. He is the door. He is the redemption path to the door. He is the altar. He is the priest. But in that day, the offerer, the priest, the sacrifice, and the altar were four separate things. It takes a lot of things for God to paint the picture. And the Old Testament believer had to come, having come by way of this tribe, through this door, he would bring with himself a perfect animal from out of the flock. He would stand in the case of the sin offerings in front of this altar and stand that animal in front of it. And lay his hands onto the head of the animal, and God, who had said, same God that said back here, for sin comes death, now said, if you put your hands on the head of the animal, I will allow you to impart judicially, it is imputed, if you want a longer word, your sins are released and placed onto that animal, and the perfection of that animal, which is as pure as you can bring from your flock, I will allow to be imputed to you the perfection that the animal had. So an exchange occurs in the laying on of hands. I step back as a believer. The animal becomes me. I become as though I'm as clean as the animal. A knife is drawn. The animal is slain. Blood poured onto the ground. Why is it so bloody? Read Leviticus 17:11 and the 14th verse of the same chapter. Life resided in the blood. I don't know where death begins. The Israelites were taught by God, when the blood's gone, you're dead. Life, the soul, resided in the blood. And God had said, for sin comes death, and that's why it's not just blood for blood's sake. And the gory details of human sacrifices around the world grow out of a man's sense of oughtness, grow out of those dim crossroads of the past, when that which flowed out of God's revelation was kept pure by those that were the oracle of God, and the caricatures went off into other streams. But the people that God selected to keep pure that stream of his revelation as he moved from that separation to that ultimate redemption, he had his people. And to those people, it was not just an exercise in gory detail. He drove home the fact God meant it when he said, for sin comes death. And that Old Testament believer had a reality of experience. We get our emotions in the wrong place. We want to come to God and feel we're saved, but it tickles up and down our spine. The feelings this Old Testament believer had were the result of his faith in a God that he believed in. And if he had emotional reactions, it was the raw, graphic reaction to watching an animal quiver and die at his feet in the knowledge, but for God's grace, that would be him, and he could walk away in the knowledge, God loved me for some strange reason enough to let that animal die for me. You ever just missed an accident? Just had it go by you and then it hit you. Some people need to look at Calvary and realize what really happened. God's eternal Son quivering and dying for me. And to walk away in some kind of warped humility and say, I wonder if I'm okay, is not humility at all. It's to question God's right to take another and to question the value to God of the one he takes in my place. That believer was set free because God said, I'll take the animal as though it were you, and I'll treat the animal as you deserve to be treated, and treat you as though you're as clean as the animal. And he walked away, free, because God let another die in his place. All the elements were there, a priest, an offerer, an offering, and an altar. Now take that pattern and look at the better way. We're separated from God. It's the book of Hebrews that says, without holiness, no man shall see God. As literally as geography separated this believer from God's presence, no man can come to God except on God's terms. And there is no door other than Jesus. He is the door. We have a sacrifice, not the blood of animals and goats. 1 John 2, Christ is the propitiation for our sins. And not for ours only, but for the sins of the whole world. Like the spender of paper money, I might question that an animal could die in my place. But when I realized that was but the paper money being spent, because the pure gold was in heaven's vault, and he did die for me and bought up all those sacrifices, I stand made worthy by the blood of the Lamb. And to question it is to question his value. I can't add to that. He's the propitiation. He's the altar. He is the sacrifice. He is the offerer. I don't have to go through all of this. Very simply, as Romans says, I'm not to think I have to ascend up there and bring him down, if I could interpolate, to do it over again, or descend into the depth and bring him up. The word's already nigh. You speak it forth. It's in your mouth. For with the heart man believeth, with the mouth confession is made. And if we confess with our mouth and believe with our heart, we're saved. That's simple. This believer had to come God's way. It was more complicated. Ours is a better way. One offering, one sacrifice, one altar. Once for all, he did it. Now all I have to do is believe and speak forth, and I'm made worthy by the blood of the Lamb. That's why I say, don't let guilt stand in front of this table. He paid it all for me. Every element. Let me finish it. This brazen altar had blood on it and fire on it. The early morning sacrifice had to be offered every day. It wasn't a pleasant thing. And notice, it wasn't outside the fence. The sacrifice was after you went through the door. The sacrifice is for those that come through Jesus. And you say, what about the heathen? I don't know. Neither does anybody else, including Paul. So don't try to get me to answer it. Paul couldn't answer it. Paul said, the only thing I'll tell you about the heathen is no matter how good they are, they're as bad off as the Jews, no matter how good they were. Because both of them, those without and those with, fell short of God's glory. What happens to them? They're in God's hands. So leave them there. Our job is to carry the light. But if the lights come on in your room, don't sit there and fail to do what the light shows you because you're worrying about all the dark rooms. God has shined the light. And the light says, I am the door through Jesus. He is the sacrifice. It remains for me to believe with the heart and speak it forth with the mouth. Are you in doubt? This old miserable brazen altar. You know what they did when the camp picked up and moved? They wrapped that altar in purple, right next to it. And then you know what they covered the purple with? Badger skins. Now, you don't, how many women run around paying big money for badger skin coats? Anybody here got a badger skin coat? Not an accident in God's plan. Badger skin. Repulsive, earthy, non-beauty. It hid the royal purple. And as this brazen altar was carried through the camp as they moved to the next location, they saw the badger skin. But God made sure between the badger skin and these horns, the purple. He saw the king in that human cloak that he assumed for us, covering the horns of that brazen altar. It was the King of Kings that died for me and you. And that worth, hidden by badger skins, is seen by God and seen through the eye of faith by everyone that recognizes Jesus, the King of Kings, died for me. One day I'll come behind him when he has on his vesture and on his thigh, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But until then, he died for me. And that's why I can come to this table, set free,